This is WFAE Talks. I'm Greg Caller. Joining me, as always, is Ben Bradford. He covers environment, energy, and anything else I assign him. Hello, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. Survived the snow?
Yeah, I did. Didn't run into anything. Didn't slide into anything. When are you going to do an a cappella version of this song for us as the intro?
An a cappella version?
Yeah.
I think this is the only version that exists.
You're not specifically going to perform an a cappella version for us at some point?
No.
You don't have to, Greg.
That's... Our listeners would be appreciative.
See, I don't think that's true. I think that our listeners would really like to hear the news director for WFAE do an a cappella version of that little, I don't even know what kind of was that, folk?
It was just an instrumental done by a former guitar teacher of mine called, his name is Brian Roberts.
So
he's from West Virginia.
So you could actually just play it live for us?
No. He could, but I couldn't.
All right. I'll let you get on with the show.
Thank you. Also joining us is Lisa Miller. She is WFAE's education reporter. Is there much going on in education these days, Lisa?
Oh, yes. Lots going on. So you'll hear about a little bit of it.
Well, I guess I admire the job you do, especially when you have to periodically hear my gripes as a parent.
Yeah, no, it's very informative. I like hearing those gripes most of the time.
Most of the time. Does it ever make your job a little tough?
No, it's pretty amusing. Yeah. I can't think of a time it made it particularly tough. So.
That's good. Well, on to our topics today. Number one, the media's snow job. Number two, virtual education. And the Gold Line, also primarily known as the streetcar. You ready to talk about that?
Ah, ready to talk about all of it.
All right. Well, let's start with the media's snow job. We had some fun in the newsroom this week making fun of some of our colleagues in the media, primarily the local TV stations. Of course, any inkling of snow, and they go crazy with the hype. It drives me crazy because I think their coverage sometimes is irresponsible and creates fear. Of course, it does give us good comedy, too.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, I'm from California. I've barely even ever seen snow unless we go up and visit it, go out to a mountain to go skiing. And I just really feel like if you were to ask from, like, a news perspective, okay, what was the story? The story was basically, oh, it's snowing. That was the story. Right? I mean,
yes.
That's pretty much it. And then, you know, I understand you want to cover the traffic
absolutely.
Parts of that.
And we did that. Yeah.
You want to cover, you know, Duncan McFadden, our reporter here, is looking into kind of an interesting thing about how the city handles the homeless during the cold and actually how it's given them a more accurate count of the number of homeless in the city. So, I mean, there's obviously interesting things, but I don't understand why a natural phenomenon that, you know, isn't especially damaging or anything along those lines is such a big story.
Right.
I was confused.
We live in an area that periodically has cold weather and periodically has snow. So why do we treat it as this huge story when this is something that part of our life here?
Lisa, well, then you miss coverage. Like I was watching a couple hours of storm coverage. I only saw a chunk of this.
From the ice desk?
Yeah, there's one station is WCNC had a special and 1 hour special cut into regular programming. The Biggest Loser. How dare they take off The Biggest Loser? They were reporting from the ice desk.
Well, so the interview that I enjoyed was this guy who had just slid into a ditch, and gosh, he was interviewed and he was so calm and so patient, and I just thought, wow, if I slid into a ditch and someone asked to interview me, I would not respond that way. So it made my heart swell a little bit for the patience of the people around here.
Great. So Lisa likes it for human interest stories. Greg hates it because it cuts into The Biggest Loser. I'm confused by it because I don't really know what snow is. No, I was actually confused by it. Like out here, I've never seen snow that. Do you guys know how fine it was? It was like it was like the size
very
of
powdery.
Sand.
It's a little over
really
an inch.
Weird. I've never seen anything like it.
Well, I have to say, I do like when, you know, despite sort of the hardship. I know there's a lot of hardship with snow and storms often, but when a weather event closes down a city, just that cocoon of comfort when everything stops. it's kind of nice, even though we still have to go to work. Yeah. You know, it's kind of a nice break from usual hectic weeks.
Sure, I can see that. You know, the other part of it is that
a break for us, not for all the like the brine trucks the out there, which
sure.
you know, there's
sure.
plenty of people working really hard
right.
in this stuff.
Right, right. But yeah, no, but you're right. I mean, you know, most you know city functions shut down, schools obviously shut down, and all that. I would say, you know, the one other thing is to be fair that you know this isn't a place like Detroit where you're from, Lisa, or. Mm-hmm. You know, or
it doesn't have all the equipment
like
and right, exactly. capacity where, for that.
Yeah, it's
sure.
like, you know, I lived in L.A. for a while, and when it rains in L.A., people kind of freak out, and it's kind of funny.
Over rain.
But, you know, at the same time, things flood really easily because the city is just not built for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it does cause problems that it wouldn't cause in, you know, in Charlotte, for instance.
But does the coverage here create unnecessary fear?
Oh, yeah. I think it's totally sensationalist.
Well,
to give a purely objective journalist's opinion.
Okay. Well, I did highlight WCNC, but I think it's fair to say I'm not that they're
complaints
all guilty
against everyone.
Yeah,
in Greg.
but I have determined that
I meant that insult for everyone.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying.
But the next time, though, I am going to assign you a weather story. I've determined. Next time there's a big storm.
Lisa.
Oh, good.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's better. That's better. Because I would be like a kitten. I wouldn't know what to do. I'd probably die out there.
WCNC also had a good blog post about which streets get plowed first, which is interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Let's move on. We spent enough on this talk.
On
this topic.
Yeah.
All right.
Our own snow coverage.
Snow coverage.
Our own.
Sorry, WFA Gripes. Lisa Miller and Ben Bradford.
Yes. Virtual education. There's no virtual education. There is one a state-sponsored virtual education system in North Carolina. It's run by the State Department of Public Instruction. But now we have some.
You can take classes in it as a student, but you can't graduate from a school okay. like that. So that's.
Well, there are efforts to change that. A couple for-profit companies want to set up virtual education, virtual schools in North Carolina. And this is. It's been going on for a couple of years now. We don't have them yet, but they haven't given up. They're still trying to get acceptance from the state, and you reported on that this week.
Sure. What we have right now is a group trying to figure out what kind of rules should be in place when the board that's in charge of vetting these virtual charters, what they should consider. So they got a chance to hear from the two companies that want to, through nonprofit boards, set up virtual charters in the state. So these two companies together would want to serve eventually in 3 years about 6,000 students across North Carolina.
And the students, how would they get funded? They would anyone in North Carolina could enroll in these classes, and then it would where would the funding come from?
Sure. Anyone could enroll, enroll in these schools, and they work like a regular charter school would as far as funding. If they were to be set up right now without any policies guiding this or changing the funding mechanism. But, you know, so for example, in a charter, you know, if a child, they would normally go to CMS, they decide to go to a charter school. The state, federal, and local funding all follow that child. And so it would be the same way for a virtual charter school.
What's the appeal of doing it?
Well, you know, it serves, you know, imagine a kid who's really sick and can't go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a option for them to be able to stay at home and still be taking classes and, you know, going through semesters and grades.
Don't we have that already? Aren't there already options for those students?
No, there aren't really options as far as our virtual.
No, I mean, but just the public school system can still serve students like that, right?
It does serve students like that. And let me say that's just
one example.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's also the idea that, you know, if you aren't thriving in a regular traditional setting, that and you're very good with self-discipline and motivation, that this might be a good way for you to work. For example, you know, yesterday they or this week the company cited bullying. If you get bullied at school, you know, if it's not a good environment, you feel your school is unsafe, then this is an option. Now, homeschool students, they have seen, you know, about 10 to 20% of kids who enroll at these virtual charters are actually homeschool students. So that's an interesting debate, too, because, you know, when the state is looking at this, they have to think, okay, well, these are students we never even had to pay for before because they were homeschool students. But, you know, obviously homeschool parents say, well, you know, we should be getting something for the tax money we do put into the system for education.
So that would be money that leaves the local public school system for any student who goes, who enrolls in a in one of these virtual schools?
Yes, that money would leave the local public school district and go to the virtual charter, the same as it is for a charter.
And that's about regular $8,000?
That's about $8,500.
In Mecklenburg County, if they're from Mecklenburg County.
That's actually about $8,500 average statewide.
Hmm. So this is a lot of money. I mean, if a lot of kids go into this or if a lot of homeschool kids are going into this, and this really adds up.
If you look at 6,000 students, at least 10% of them are going into that. I mean, yeah, that's a sizable amount.
And I would imagine that if it's all online, that their bottom line would be a little bit better, that they wouldn't have to have as much expenses as, you know, your usual school where you have to supply the facility. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see kind of
well,
kind of the results,
you know,
there.
And it's interesting because you think with a charter school, they provide that brick and mortar building.
Right.
And virtual charters say, okay, you know, how states have looked at it is you have to provide that internet connection and that computer as your infrastructure.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they would be profitable if these are for-profit companies. Wouldn't it make sense then to, hey, give them a – We'll buy you a computer. We're getting $8,500 for you anyway for the year, and we'll set up your internet connection.
You're making a profit.
Sure, and this is something that the state is trying to get its head around. So right now, how it's written up is that these schools would get about $3,500 a year because that's what it costs to take a full load of virtual classes through the state's virtual system. Now, you know, the companies say, actually, our expenses aren't that, you know, much less than, you know, a brick and mortar school. And of course, people say, dispute that. So I talked to the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, and he's saying, yeah, it looks like it doesn't cost as much. And from the taxpayer standpoint, I mean, why would you want to fund more than what something costs?
But these companies are for profit. They have to serve shareholders too.
Sure. Sure. That's the quandary, and that's what gets many people upset. And the companies say, and other people say too, hey, if they're doing a good job,
right.
why should we differentiate? But
sure.
Then it comes into question, are you doing a good job? Because the quality of those charters has really been rough in many states. The kids aren't up to state standards, and the charter companies say, "Hey, well, this is only good for a select group of students."
Well, an interesting point you raised, I think, in your story, or that really the committee that's looking at these issues raised, is how do you judge the standards for these schools? I mean, because current charter schools have to show academic growth. If you have so much turnover with virtual schools, and you have students that are having trouble anyway, how do you judge and hold them to the same standards as everyone else? Can you?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're trying to mull over. And then, you know, you have to look at funding too, is another piece of this, as far as when do these, you know, if it is a for-profit company, you know, you have to build in this incentive to succeed. So if you get your money up front for a student and they drop out 3 months later, well, you still have that money. So, you know, one suggestion from the man I spoke to with the group NAXA said,
what's that?
That's the charter school authorizers group. He said, you know, you pay charters after they complete the courses. So, you know, I'm sure that's going to be something that they may have to mull over too, this group.
You have a tough job. You got to say that. You have a tough job.
how so?
It's tough to keep track of all this.
It is. But it's intriguing. So.
It is intriguing.
It's good.
Intriguing. Well, let's move on. The Gold Line, also primarily known as the streetcar. They've changed the name of the streetcar, Ben?
Yeah, they changed the name. You know, the streetcar was controversial, but the Gold Line sounds nice.
Oh, it sounds slick.
Right, exactly. And it also falls, I think what they've tried to do is kind of standardize it also. You've got your blue line. You know, ultimately, you're talking about having a red line, and then you've got the Gold Line. And what could be better than gold?
Money? I don't know.
It depends on who you ask.
Well, they spent a lot of money, or they've approved spending a lot of money, $12 million on some planning for a 2.5-mile extension of
right.
the Gold
so,
Line.
So basically right now we have kind of a starter part of the streetcar that's being built. And if you go into Uptown around, you know, Davidson and Trade Street, you'll see all this construction, all these closures. Although Greg and I were commenting, we don't actually know when they do it because everything's changing. There's clearly a lot of building going on. But I every time I'm down there, I feel like I don't see it. So
they are working. We just
never
see
it. Absolutely are. So anyway, so that and that's going to run through basically from down Elizabeth Street into Uptown, and that's a small section. And the bigger section, the city wants to build a 2.5-mile extension to it. That's going to run essentially from the Elizabeth area up in about 7th and Hawthorne down to Johnson C. Smith University, and. To do that, they're anticipating it's going to cost about $126 million. So the original controversy over the streetcar was, all right, how do you build it? It was a big Anthony Fox, former mayor Anthony Fox, it was one of his big priorities. And he initially wanted to do it through a raise in the property tax and then using that money to pay for it. And the majority of the city council balked on that. And the ultimate compromise was that they are going to seek out federal grant money to pay for about half of it, and the other half would come through local funds, and they wouldn't use a property tax increase. So now they're at a point where they're seeking this big federal grant, and essentially they have to do more prep work. Right now it's what's called 30% designed, and so which is kind of interesting when you think about it, right? I think when I thought about this and when I called up the city, I was thinking to myself, well, yeah, they must already have it designed, right? They must already know how they're going to do it. But really, you're talking about kind of the broad strokes. And you're talking about, you know, some very specific broad strokes, where the station's going to be, where is it going to run, how is it going to do that, what kind of land do we need, those sort of things. But there's more engineering costs. It's going to cost about $12 million. And you need that to get it ready to apply for this grant program. These are to meet
how much is that grant
program. Well, the grant would give them essentially what they'd be asking for is a little over $60 million, which would be half the funding needed to do this 2.5-mile extension.
And then the whole thing is about, what, 10 miles? If they
the whole thing would run about 10 miles. And I don't have the figure. I'm not even sure that the figure's out for ultimately how much that would cost. But you figure that, you know, 126 for 2.5. So, you know, basically quadruple that. And no, that's not right. My math is bad. I guess you have to do like 8 times that for 10 miles, but then minus 2.5 miles. Okay, I'm not doing that math.
You're
right
journalist.
Now.
Don't.
Yeah,
get
thank
the math
you.
On
I'll
fly.
Break. Right. My head will break.
Now, what's the argument for the streetcar again? Because, I mean, you know,
economic
there are buses,
yeah.
There's, but it could, you know, why not a Lynx? You know, why
sure.
not a light rail?
Sure.
Why is it a streetcar?
I think that's a great question.
It's going to take
question.
About the same amount of time, right, to commute uptown as it would on a bus.
I think it's a very good question. The main argument that people put forth for the streetcar is economic development. They talk about it kind of revitalizing corridors. I think, you know, the other part of the streetcar is it runs on the same streets. The only thing you need dedicated land for is for the stations and for the stops. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the blue line, for instance, right, it's running through this kind of median. So I'd have to go back and look at it, but I would imagine that some of those medians don't exist in all the places
yeah.
they want to run it.
Yeah,
so,
I haven't seen any. They're building out the tracks along Elizabeth right now and, you know, up into Uptown, as you said. And I haven't seen any medians along there. But
right. So, I mean, right. If you look along, you know, some of those streets, you don't it just doesn't exist. So in terms of planning, how are you going to do that? How are you going to run some kind of public transit through there? That's, you know, it runs on the street, which is sort of the appeal of it. But at the same time, you're right, because that also means it gets stuck in traffic, waits at lights and those kinds of things.
Now, a lot of cities used to have these. Used to be quite common, even in smaller cities in Charlotte.
Charlotte used to. I mean, a lot of the old neighborhoods, you know, Dilworth, I think Elizabeth, they were old, called streetcar neighborhoods.
It's a very old technology. It's been around for a very long time. Yeah, I know in New York they had some in Brooklyn that were running a long time ago. But the main argument for it now is that they're saying economic development. You build these things. You have more people kind of traveling along these things. Businesses want to be there.
Because it's
fixed. It'll revitalize some of these quarters.
It's not like a bus route that can change.
That's right.
Well, it feels like there's a little bit of momentum going for this project now. It didn't feel that way a couple of years ago. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think that's right. I mean, it's already in. So basically, the funding has been set aside in the capital improvement plan. What they need is the grant. If they don't get this grant, the city says that, well, we'll have this work done and we can use it. It'll be good for about 4 to 6 years to keep applying for other grants until we get it. And they also say that that's a fairly common thing. You know, you don't get one grant, you apply for another, you get this project on the radar. The one thing that, you know, that's kind of funny about it is you might think that having former Mayor Anthony Fox, who was the champion of the streetcar, have him now as the secretary of the Department of Transportation, which is going to be where they're applying for all these awards. But of course, he has to recuse himself because it was his project, so he's not going to be involved. The way that they've set it up is that they need the federal grant to make it work. I mean, yeah, I guess it's
so
possible.
So it might take like 15 years to build if we don't get a federal grant or something.
If you were asking me to predict, I would say if they don't get the federal grant, then they can't do it because that's the way that they've set up. And then you don't have a streetcar because that's the way it's set up. And obviously there's some entrenched resistance to it, and there's entrenched resistance to paying a lot of city money for it. So they really need the federal grant. But I would also say that I think that for projects of these kinds, ultimately, if they play it right and they design it right and they set up and they do their work properly, this is something that that the government, these are the kinds of grants the government tends to fund.
And city manager Ron Carley certainly seems committed to this project.
Yes.
Okay. We've done it again. Another episode of WFE Talks. Congratulations.
Hey.
Take care, guys.
All right, cool. Thank you.